Good afternoon. This is Monday, March 23rd. This is the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing. We have a very long agenda. This is second deadline week, so we're going to try to move as many bills through as we possibly can. On the agenda today are nine bills and one informational presentation. The first bill on our agenda is Senate File 311. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I have today the Senate File 311, which is a request for state funds for a two-year transitional rental voucher program. I have with me my testifiers, and I will be introducing them after my comments. Madam Chair, also have an amendment, A1 amendment, if someone would offer it for me.
Thank you. Is this your first stop?
This is the first stop.
Okay. Senator Wicklund offers the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
Thank you.
I failed to announce that there was a quorum, but so we were in good order there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Please proceed. First of all, I want to say that I have been an appointed member of the Council of Asian Pacific Minnesotans. This is my third year. I was appointed at the beginning of 2013, and therefore I have become much more informed and educated about some of the challenges facing the Asian Pacific community here in Minnesota. So as I said, this requests that the state funds a two-year transitional rental voucher program to serve women and children from Asian and other emerging ethnic communities who are victims of domestic violence and are at risk of being homeless. Although we are asking that this program be designed with women from emerging ethnic communities, this program will be accessible to victims regardless of their race. Domestic violence is a leading cause of homelessness among women and children. In a 2006 report by the U.S. Conference of Mayors, 44% of the cities surveyed identified domestic violence as the primary cause of homelessness among families. For the victims from our Asian and emerging ethnic communities, homeless shelters are not an option due to cultural values and beliefs. For some, domestic violence shelters are the last resort. For the majority, domestic violence shelters are not an option at all. When they do access these domestic violence shelters, the average stay is around 45 days, while the average length of time it takes them to secure housing is 8 to 12 months or longer. Senate File 311 recognizes the challenges a unique group of women face and addresses them. Our hope is that this program will empower victims from ethnic communities to understand how they are not alone and ultimately their necessity to seek safety. Secondly, we wish to prevent homelessness and provide housing stability to our most vulnerable women with children. With me today are the two testifiers that are seated beside me, Ms. Claudia Warren, who is the Executive Director of the Asian Women United of Minnesota, the only domestic violence program serving the Asian Pacific community in Minnesota, and B. Benson is a licensed family and marriage therapist who provides in-house therapy at the Asian Women United of Minnesota shelter and is an independent practitioner in the community. Madam Chair, with that, I would ask for our testifiers to come forward and speak.
Thank you. Ms. Waring?
Yes.
Please say your name into the microphone and then begin your testimony.
My name is Claudia Waring. I'm the Executive Director of Asian Women United of Minnesota. I've been there for just under 5 years. Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I have about 2.5 minutes of prepared remarks. I'm here to provide a little bit of information on who might benefit from this bill. Asian Women United provides emergency shelter, support, and advocacy to women who aim to live violence-free lives. More than 90% of the women who come to our shelter, which we call House of Peace, are Asian, and they represent the diversity of the Asian Pacific community in Minnesota. Of those women, over 75% are immigrants and refugees. In addition, we provide shelter to immigrants and refugees from other areas of the world. Most nights, the House of Peace is full of women and children who have been uprooted from their homes and are uncertain about where they will go after their shelter stay expires. In a typical year, Asian Women United provides shelter to between 100 and 125 women and children and offers community advocacy services like crisis calls, community-based consultation, and support groups to 1,000 additional individuals. On average, 775 requests for shelter are unmet because our shelter is full or because a caller is screened out because it's determined she's not in immediate danger, but she's in fact homeless. As most of us know, women and children who are homeless face a huge risk of encountering violence. So it's only a matter of time for many of these women and children before they suffer violence themselves. I also want to let you know that several babies are born at the House of Peace each year. Women come to shelter when they're pregnant, they deliver their babies, and they return to the shelter with infant in arms. The House of Peace is the first home for many of our babies and may be the only stable home they have for many months once they leave shelter. A typical House of Peace resident has undergone profound levels of abuse, both physical and emotional. The next step for her and her children must be a safe and secure place to live. Ideally, women and children should depart shelter to homes of their own, but unfortunately, this is a relatively rare occurrence. Nearly 70% of the women and children that we served in the last year went from shelter into another tenuous living situation. Only 5% of the women served in 2013 were able to access and enter transitional housing. I believe you have a chart that will just give you an illustration of where people go from shelter. Common barriers faced by immigrant and refugee-battered women include low English proficiency, little to no work history in the United States, no driver's license, no credit history. Many women face so many barriers that their stays at the shelter are lengthy, much longer than the 45 days that we aim for. Just a couple weeks ago, I listened to an advocate share her frustration that a shelter resident was declined from what had appeared to be a promising transitional housing situation because, according to the staff person on the other line, the woman would require an interpreter to participate in meetings and on-site programming. As you can see, language is a primary barrier for women who are trying to access mainstream transitional housing. This is why AWOM supports legislation that would dedicate resources to providing safe, affordable housing specifically to immigrant and refugee women and children. 20 years ago, our foremothers founded AWOM on the principle that while the existing mainstream battered women's services were excellent, they were not culturally comprehensive. As most people know, homelessness, whether literally on the streets, in a homeless shelter, or because of overcrowding with family or friends, exposes women and children to the risk of more abuse, insecurity, and hopelessness. We need to support these women so they can raise their children in peace, so they are not compelled to return to abusive homes or compromise their welfare because other options do not exist. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We now will have testimony from Bevu Benson.
Thank you.
Would you introduce yourself and say your name so that it's closer to how it's pronounced than what I might have just said?
My name is Bevu Benson. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to speak in front of you today. I am a survivor of domestic violence. I am also the on-site therapist at the domestic violence shelter operated by Asian Women United of Minnesota. Over the past 5 years, I worked with many women and children who have been impacted mentally, physically, spiritually, and economically by domestic violence, sexual assaults, sex trafficking, international abusive marriages, and forced cultural marriages. When they come to the shelter, these women and children have left behind nearly all of their personal belongings and their homes. Without the Asian Women United of Minnesota and other shelters in the area, they would be homeless. Shelter becomes a new and stable home for the families. However, it is only a short-lived home. Today, I want to share the story of a survivor who has given us permission to tell her story at this committee hearing. Mai Khu, only a fictitious name, is a young woman from Laos. She was 20 years old when she met a 56-year-old Hmong American man traveling in Laos. During their courtship, he mentioned that he was previously married but had no children. He told her he loved her and would care for her. He met her family and sought their permission to marry her. Gradually, she fell in love and agreed to marry him, believing he was an honorable man. When Mai Khu arrived in Minnesota, however, she quickly saw that her husband's first wife was still living with him. She realized she was brought to the United States to be a second wife and to bear children for them. During the 5 years she stayed with the couple, she was not allowed to attend school, learn English, or work outside the home. Moreover, the husband did not complete the necessary immigration paperwork to allow her to legally stay in the United States and eventually apply for citizenship. Mai Khu was pregnant year after year with little say in the matter. She endured 5 years of sexual exploitation, physical abuse, emotional trauma, and social isolation. Her own children, ages 4, 3, and 1, were not even allowed to address Mai Khu as mother. They called their mother by her first name only. Instead, the children were instructed to address the first wife as mother. When Mai Khu discovered herself pregnant with a fourth child, she finally found the courage to leave the abusive relationship. She was attending a family funeral when she asked someone for help, and that person dropped her off at our shelter. There, she received help from legal aid to obtain an order for protection, file for divorce, and complete her immigration application. During her stay at the shelter, Mai Khu applied for over 15 different transitional and public housing programs and did not receive any housing support. These housing programs had layers of program requirements that made Mai Khu and her children ineligible. As her monthly income of child support and food assistance was just a little over $900, she did not have enough money to pay for the security deposit and the first month of rent. Mai Khu ended up taking shelter with a relative's family. 4 years later, she is still moving from one crowded relative's home to another, with no stable housing for her young children or herself. As a therapist who has worked closely with women like Mai Khu and many others in similar situations of exploitation and abuse, I have witnessed the enormous difficulty they have experienced with trying to find affordable housing. It is very clear that we need more rental assistance programs and supporter services for these vulnerable women and children. I urge you to support and fund Senate File 311. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, that completes my testimony. However, there is a handout here from Sue Watlaw Phillips.
We have other written testimony, so we'll make sure that gets distributed, Senator, to the members of the committee. We appreciate that. Our time, of course, is very tight today, so we can't allow a longer public testimony. Unless there is someone who wishes to testify in opposition to the bill. Not in favor, in opposition. Senator.
Madam Chair, I do have a statement also from Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope and the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium, and I will leave that for the committee.
Thank you. We have that, and it's being distributed to the members of the committee. Is there any, I just would like to start out, Senator Nelson, we've had a number of wonderful proposals such as this one come in front of us, but one of the things that the committee would ask for is, and what we notice is that we need more specific outcome measurements and language that requests a progress report on this. So, for example, what I would recommend is language such as has been described by your testifiers, some measure of whether or not people were able to stay emergent from an abusive environment, some documentation, some study of that, employment, a successful achievement of employment and increasing economic stability, improved credit or the development of a credit history might be something that would be a goal and a measurement, drivers attaining a driver's license, all of those things that have been barriers that would be part of this process. As a result of this initiative, are we able to see positive outcomes that just delay a regression into a circumstance that makes it impossible for the person to be able to stay outside of a victimized session. So we would need language for that before we get to the Finance Committee. And so it would be some kind of report. You indicate that require participants in the program to actively seek employment or activities that will assist them gaining future employment. It might be education. So we need to have a report on those measurements of the positive outcomes of this initiative.
Madam Chair, can that be done between now?
Now in finance, yes. Okay. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate those good comments as well and questions. Those were long lines of mine. I just have one comment. I really appreciate, Senator Johnson, the A1 amendment, because domestic violence, sexual assault, sexual trafficking does not know racial boundaries. It's a universal problem. So I really appreciate the A1 amendment that recognizes that. And then I have a question in addition to the ones that Senator Sharon asked, and that is I'd like to know, we have a number of housing programs in this state already, and I would like to know what the interaction is with this and those housing programs. Maybe if Commissioner Tingerthal or someone from her department is here, they can talk about that. But so I do wonder why we would not use maybe some of the existing housing programs. And I don't know if there's anyone here from the department to talk about that. And then the other question would be, if there is someone from the department, is there any double dipping here, or how would you designate this program and the recipients from this grant proposal as opposed to the other housing programs we have in the state?
Thank you, Senator Nelson. Is there someone here from the department that would be able to answer these questions? Anyone here prepared to talk about the interfacing?
From the Department of Human Services, which was mentioned in the bill, but not from Minnesota Housing, and we've spoken with Minnesota.
Yes.
Well, are you able to speak to and answer some of these questions?
Yes, I am.
Would you please approach and give your name?
Madam Chair, while the representative from the department is coming forward, some of our testimony that we would bring out if we had more time would be the culture of the Asian community, and particularly their resistance to reaching out to government programs because of their culture. They are not accustomed to it, and that's why we believe that it was at one point we were having just Asian Pacific women and children, but then we were asked to, and it seemed very wise to include everyone in it, but there is a need in the Asian Pacific community because of their culture.
It's a unique need you're describing. Would we in the bill, I just would note to everyone that under Section 2 of the appropriation, the first appropriation is to the Commissioner of Housing Finance for grants for exploited women, children, rental assistance, and then the second is appropriations to the Commissioner of Human Services for grants. So with that,
Madam Chair, members
of the committee. And supportive services.
My name is Isaac Wangard from the Department of Human Services, and I would just speak to the question of coordination, I believe, between
yes.
the housing programs. We did note in our fiscal note that there are some programs currently that could accomplish this purpose, but we would, if awarded this, we would, of course, coordinate with Minnesota Housing. I understand the rental assistance would be a pilot under the Housing Trust Fund. That is not a program, obviously, that DHS administers, but we do administer the Transitional Housing Program in 256C33. So to your question, we coordinate with Minnesota Housing whenever we're asked to on their RFP process. We try to provide input, and if there was funding that was appropriated to be coordinated, we would make sure that when we do our competitive request for proposals, we're reaching out to those agencies who received the Housing Trust Fund funding. So as it's written now, it need to be administered as a separate appropriation at the Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair, just
Senator Nelson.
One follow-up question. I understand the specific plight of women who are involved in domestic abuse and how difficult it is to leave that situation, or sexual trafficking for that matter as well. Are there already housing programs that that work specifically with women who are involved in these type of difficult situations?
So would you say your name again? Because I didn't hear your last name,
That's
Isaac.
It's, my name is Isaac, and the last name is Wingard.
Wingard, Wingard.
Yeah,
thank you.
W-E-N-G-E-R-D. Yes, there are programs that target victims of domestic violence in a transitional housing setting. We fund approximately 8 of those statewide. The Department of Public Safety has some state and federal funds. Mm-hmm. I can't speak to those specifically. I think there have been questions about access, and we try to do quite a broad outreach to emerging communities, sending our competitive RFP, but we have not had any culturally specific providers from this community apply for our transitional housing funds. But
thank you.
And Senator Nelson, someone is here from Minnesota Housing Finance Agency to you might, the question really is about coordination of this program with human services and with other housing programs that we have in the state. Please say your name and who you represent.
Sure, thank you. Madam Chair, I'm Katie Topinka from the Housing Finance Agency. Sorry, we're double booked today, so I'm running between hearings. I think you just heard a little bit from the Department of Human Services. They do primarily handle the services and transitional housing around, from the Safe Harbor Bill, victims of trafficking, those kinds of things. We do work closely with the Department of Human Services through our existing rental assistance program. We provide rental assistance through what we call the Housing Trust Fund, which is mentioned in this bill. And what we do is we purely provide the rental assistance. So we work with nonprofit administrators who then work with the households and get the rental assistance payments to them. We do not provide services, but we do work closely with the Department of Human Services to make sure that households that are receiving rental assistance from us are also receiving the services that they need. With this bill, that's how, if it were to pass, that's how we would envision that the model would continue to work. Minnesota Housing would provide rental assistance and then partner with Department of Human Services on the services side.
Senator Nelson, one more along this line, and then I think we need to, I think it will be referred to finance, of course, for further consideration, but to the policy itself, we need to move the bill forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is to the question of, one of the questions I've always had about our housing is we have all these different programs, mm-hmm. and I always worry about adding one more, and then when somebody needs to access housing, how do they know which program to apply for? It's very complex, really. I've tried to get charts of that, and so my only fear, Senator Johnson, is that we would add one more housing program, making it much more difficult for people to determine which housing program is best going to serve them. And so that's just my caution.
Senator Hayden.
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Johnson, thank you for bringing the bill, and I'd like to move it.
Oh, there's a motion to move by Senator Hayden, Senate File 311. Just for further discussion, I think that as we move this through finance, that perhaps we can talk more about the interplay, as Senator Nelson has been talking about, but also I just want to reiterate that I'd be hesitant to move the bill forward without a commitment from you that there will be language about how successful or unsuccessful or whatever you are with this, if it should pass, to accomplish its objectives, which is to stabilize people economically, get driver's licenses, get employment, get long-term stable housing, and to keep and to track whether people are going back, because of those efforts, are able to stay out of victimizing situations.
Senator, Madam Chair, and Senators, you have our commitment, and Ms. Dolkar from the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans came to the table to discuss some of this stuff, but we are listening, and we will be ready with responses to you and to the Finance Committee.
Thank you. If we could have an amendment at that time to articulate
yes.
that, you'll run into that same resistance in finance without it. So, on the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Excuse me. The motion is to pass the bill as amended to finance. All those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed say nay. Passes. Thank you very much.
And consideration.
The next bill is Senate File 870, Senator Eakin. Thank you very much, Senator Eakin. We are on the last week before second deadline, so I'm hoping, I didn't say for the first time in the committee so far this year that we are an hour and a half meeting, much shorter than it has been in past years, so I've asked the authors and their testifiers to be very succinct without losing the ability to articulate what the problem is and how the bill resolves that problem. Thank you, Senator Eakin.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 870 is a bill that is to provide home modification assistance for people with disabilities. And these home modifications can mean the difference between continuing to live at home and leaving it for institutional care. And continuing to live in one's home promotes emotional well-being, independence, and maintaining a connection to the community. And it's also more cost-effective than institutional care. Falling in one's home is one of the leading causes of visits to emergency rooms and hospitalization, and this bill would help with modifications such as installing ramps, lifts, grab bars, or hallway and room remodels that are sometimes a necessity. But these home renovations are costly. A homeowner or a person with a disability or a senior could spend on average nearly $9,000 or upwards to tens of thousands to 20 or even in some cases up to $50,000. This bill would create a financial assistance program through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency for those who modify an existing home to increase accessibility. The applicant must be living with a disability or be over the age of 65 and have an income under 450% of the federal poverty guidelines. And I do have a author's amendment. This is the first stop, and it is a delete all amendment that I would like to pass also. And I do have an oral amendment to that delete all if I could incorporate that.
Yes, do you wish to? Excuse
so
me.
Move that.
Senator Rosen moves the A1.
And Madam Chair, the.
I better hear your oral amendment to the delete all before we move the delete all.
Madam Chair, the it would be on the second page. On line 2.24, to delete after disability period the remainder of that sentence and to remove the sentence on 2.25.
Senator Rosen moves the A1 amendment with the oral amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. The motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I do have with me Dan Andresen as well, from who is the public policy manager for the MS Society for the Upper Midwest chapter.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson? Thank you. Please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Dan Andreessen. I'm the public policy manager for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society's Upper Midwest chapter. Our chapter serves over 11,000 Minnesotans who are living with multiple sclerosis, and we help them live their best lives possible. As the Senator said, Senate File 870 is a bill to help Minnesotans who are elderly or living with a disability maintain their independence by modifying their homes to increase accessibility and safety. I'd like to thank Senator Eakin for his leadership on this bill, which is also supported by several groups, including AARP, the Minnesota State Council on Disability, and the Metropolitan Center for Independent Living. Almost all of us at some point in our lives will experience a disability, whether as a result of a chronic disease, illness, developmental disability, accident, or age. And as those people choose to age in place and people with disabilities seek to the independence of living in their homes, many may face challenges to keep their home safe and accessible. The Senator explained the bill very thoroughly, so I'll probably end my testimony right there.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your brevity. It gives the committee a little more time to ask you questions. If we use the time up by testimony a little bit too much, they may not orient themselves. Are there any questions on this Senate file? I would like to... Senator Marty and Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, Senator Eakin, the original bill had percentages of repayment of backup financial assistance based on income levels. The new bill doesn't. Who is determining what the levels of assistance are?
Senator Eakin.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, the amendment changed it from a tax credit to a grant program. So that changed the nature of how that would be determined who would get it. It would be the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency that determines where these grants are going to be appropriated. Madam Chair, one of the reasons we decided to move to a grant program is that doing it as a tax credit, that would be money that would come on the backside, so it may not be helpful to those who really need it at the time. The grant would provide the money up front.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Eakin. Generally like the idea. I would like to see between now and finance some language about targeting those who are most in need. It's not that 450% of federal poverty guidelines is too high. I just would prefer if we have an MA qualified person or somebody who's living in deep poverty that they be given priority. And I don't know if someone from the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency is here to discuss that. That might be the way they prioritize it. But I think if we're going to appropriate this much money, I think it should be targeted at those who have the least likelihood of paying for it themselves.
Madam Chair,
Senator Eakin
and Senator Benson, I understand your concerns, but many of those with disabilities are also paying very high costs for their medical care as well. So even at maybe a higher income level, they're still expending a lot of their resources just for their medical care, and that's one of the reasons for the cap being placed where it is.
Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, Senator Eakin, I'm not on the finance division as many of these other members are, but I do think that obviously some people who have modest modifications, more grab bars, ramps, and so on, may cost less than when you're doing some more extensive changes. And obviously, given $2 million a year, you're probably not going to meet all the needs. So I was just going to say you might talk with the agency about how they might choose prioritization, what it would be, so the committee might have some help with that. So, Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I think that's a great suggestion.
Okay, thank you. Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had similar comments on the 450%. For example, I was just looking up the federal poverty guidelines, and at 450% for a husband and wife, that's $72,000 a year. That's not exactly low income. I understand your point where they may have some pretty significant medical expenses, but I think the program, the grant program, if you get this into law, would be well served by trying to look at more a more targeted formula. You certainly could account for and define what are qualified medical expenses and allow that as an income deduction, things like that. I don't serve on the Finance Committee, so I wanted to get that comment in here and maybe get the juices flowing. Maybe you can work with Senator Benson, Senator Marty, with the department. But I think if you were to look at a little more robust language to try to target those resources, you can still get to who you're trying to get to without throwing in a couple that are making $72,000 a year and maybe really don't have much in the way of medical expenses and really could afford to put in a lift or a ramp or whatever.
And Senator Eakin, my thought about it, besides the messages so far, is that there be a statewide distribution? Is there anything in the bill that assures a statewide distribution? And also, I wondered, because I thought I heard you talking about the capacity of the bill to keep people in their homes rather than having to go to something of a higher expense, structured and higher expense. So maybe, I don't know if there's some assessment of that, whether or not the circumstance that's being this grant is being asked for is in fact going to create that outcome rather than simply handicap accessibility options that may or may not be needed in order to really target the group you're talking about, the goal of what you're trying to achieve, which is to keep people in their homes. If they had these modifications, they could stay there rather than just having to go someplace else. So if you could think about as you're preparing amendments before the next committee, geographic distribution language, and being really clear that at least a measurable outcome for it should be something that tells us that this investment does in fact achieve some outcomes, and that's unclear for me in the bill as well, and how that would be reviewed and reported upon back to the legislature or to the commissioner. So those two elements. All of these grant things coming through, we really need to have measurable outcomes and to know how we're going to understand how this investment, if it's made by the state, is in fact assisting us in achieving the outcomes. Cost savings, for example, that you're talking about. Senator Hayden on the bill.
Oh, it looks like Senator Marty has a question. I was going to move the bill.
Senator
Hayden? I'd like to move the bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Hayden moves Senate File 870 as amended be passed and referred as amended to the floor. To the floor? Yep. No.
Finance.
Yeah. No, finance.
It's a grant. It's got to go to finance. Whoops.
Not mine. MHFA is somebody else.
Hold it, hold it. I mean,
It is to go to finance.
Madam Chair, I believe it has to go to Senator Tomassoni's committee, so it would have
so
to
that's
finance.
Jobs and what's the name of it? It's just finance. Okay, we're just to finance. All right. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say nay. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Okay, we're going to move now to Senator Franzen's bill, Senate File 633, and I've been asked just to announce people are uncertain as to the members of our audience, you are welcome to stay through the whole day and into the evening. But if you are here for the presentation on Senator Eaton's bill on compassionate care, that is not going to be heard until the evening hearing, which we'll be recessing this hearing and regathering at 5:30 in this room. And that is in the later part of the agenda. So everyone's welcome to be here and to stay and to hear about the work that we do in this committee. But if that's what you are here for, I just want to make sure you understand that particular presentation is not until later this evening. Okay, Senator Franzen, welcome to the committee. And as you know, we are a very tight schedule. I see a couple testifiers that lots of times testifiers say I only have 2 minutes and it turns into five. So I'm hoping that you will make sure that you're good to your word here. Thank you very much, Senator Franzen.
And members, Senate File 633 provides a 10% reimbursement rate increase for chemical dependency treatment services in Minnesota to maintain and increase access to high-quality, cost-effective care that is tied to reducing ER visit, hospital stays, and incarcerations. And this request represents an estimated $25 million over the next 2 years to invest in what is deemed cost-effective care by DHS. As you may know, chemical dependency impacts one in three families, with 90% of those affected receiving inadequate treatment or no treatment at all. And not effectively treating chemical dependency costs society over $400 billion per year, according to the Office of National Drug Control Policy. And in Minnesota, that's that cost is about $7 billion a year. This treatment, chemical dependency treatment, not only works, but it's also cost-effective and saves Minnesota taxpayers money. The estimated return on investment is for every dollar, it returns a $12 in savings. And we know that chemical dependency treatment works and would like to develop performance measures to demonstrate that. And that's why part of the bill, which is a very simple bill, two-section bill, calls for that. The first section provides for the 10% increase, and then the second section requires DHS to work with providers, state agencies, tribes, counties, and health plans to develop performance measures to assess the outcomes of chemical dependency treatment. With me, I have two testifiers, Mr. John Pacheco, who's the board chair of CLUES, and Ms. Heidi Kamer from the Minnesota Association of Resources for Recovering Chemical Health. And I do have an author's amendment. I don't know if you want to move that now.
Yes, we should do that now. It's the A1 amendment, author's amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Wicklund offers the A1 amendment to Senate File 633. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Thank you very much. It passes. And Senator Franzen, you may have mentioned in your comments, and I might have missed it as I was working through the agenda here, but this, how long has it been since there's been an increase in chemical dependency funding?
Madam Chair, I'll let my testifier to my left, Heidi Kramer, to elaborate on that in her testimony, if that's okay.
That'd be perfect. Please begin. Say your name into the microphone.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Heidi Kramer. I'm the Vice President of Chemical and Mental Health Care with Resource, and today I'm here representing a statewide coalition of providers, the Minnesota Association of Treatment Directors, and MARCH, the Minnesota Association of Resources for Recovery and Chemical Health. And so in response to your question about how long has it been since there's been a rate increase, I can also, our Department of Human Services is here and could provide specific dates, but it has been nearly two decades since there has been an increase, and rates are currently 42% below the CPI. There was a cost of living increase in the 90s.
Thank you very much. Is that your testimony? please, we need to move to your testimony so that we can, so that the committee can ask you the questions to help them clarify what they need to.
Very good. So, in response to our testimony, so we are representing a statewide coalition, which again includes MARCH and MATAD. This includes 350 providers from across the state in both greater Minnesota and in the metro area. We represent a vibrant workforce of over 20,000 individuals that includes licensed professionals such as licensed alcohol and drug counselors, licensed mental health professionals, and other allied professionals and recovery support professionals. As a coalition of providers, we provide treatment to nearly 50,000 individuals and families per year. And as Senator Franzen mentioned, that we are here today advocating for the 750,000 individuals and families who are impacted by substance abuse, chemical dependency, or addiction, and only 11% receiving access to the care that they need. We know that treatment works and recovery is possible. We understand that today the committee's focus is on outcomes and policy implications. We are committed as a coalition to demonstrating the return on investment, cost savings, as well as treatment efficacy in working together with the Department of Human Services and other key stakeholders. We currently participate in a statewide evaluation system called DANES, Drug and Alcohol Abuse Normative Evaluation System, and NOMS, National Outcome Measured System. And we would like to build upon the current evaluation and outcome systems in support of this bill. Studies have found that for every dollar invested, there's a $12 return. In closing, I'd like to say that the heart of this bill is embedded in health and wellness for Minnesota's individuals and families. Treatment shows that treatment does work and that treatment works and that recovery is possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Pacheco?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Pacheco, and I'm the chair of the board of CLUES, Comunidades Latinas Unidas en Servicio, our Latinos Communities United in Service. CLUES was founded for Latinos by Latinos 35 years ago and is today the largest Latino-led agency in the state, providing direct services to approximately 15,000 people annually. CLUES services are delivered by close to 100 staff and over 800 volunteers. Our holistic services are delivered under a family-centric model that focuses on lifting two generations at once, working with parents and their children and building healthy, stable homes for them to thrive socially, emotionally, educationally, and financially. The Minnesota Latino population is growing. There are currently 280,000 Latinos residing in Minnesota, and the number of individuals who identify themselves as Latino origin is expected to almost triple by 2030. Unfortunately, there is a critical need for chemical dependency, early intervention, and recovery services in this community. Yet there are very few culturally and linguistically appropriate services available that are developed with the values and customs of the Latino population in mind. Among persons age 12 and older, in the 2013 National Survey on Drug Use and Health, 43% of Hispanics reported using alcohol. Exacerbating this issue, an additional 10% of U.S. Latino population age 12 and older reported substance dependence or abuse, a level higher than whites at 9%, blacks at 8.8%, Asians at 3.5%. Further, according to 2011 Hispanic Latino Substance Use and Consequences in Minnesota report by the Minnesota State Outcomes Work Group, a disproportionate percentage of Hispanic Latinos are arrested for driving under the influence and narcotics. And incarcerated for drug offenses, Latinos who made up only 4% of the Minnesota population from 2005 to 2009 accounted for between 6 and 7% of persons arrested for DUI and between 7 and 8% of all persons arrested for narcotics during that time. The primary goal of programs provided through CLUES Community Health Services Division is to provide non-threatening environment within the Latino community where clients are able to work on improving their chemical dependency and drug use abuse behavior patterns. We assist clients as they move into healthy, rewarding, and self-sufficient and sober lifestyles. CLUES works to accomplish this goal by improving the social, emotional adjustment and chemical health of Latino newcomers by employing culturally appropriate best practices in chemical health care, providing individual and group counseling in order to promote sober living and create stable, healthy families by support networks, and conducting outreach to promote the program and eliminate disparities in chemical health outcomes in the community. As you can see, CLUES in 2014, we served approximately 1,000 clients in chemical health services. 680 individuals underwent Rule 25 assessments. 132 individuals were involved in our Family Unidas program, a family-centric, holistic, early intervention, long-term recovery and support service. 50 individuals participated in the Driving with Care program and 34 in chemical health services. We're supporting this bill because we think the resources needed, the increase in the resources that are needed are very, very much appropriate at this time. We think it will provide us the increased access to appropriate service to help confronting substance abuse, dependency, and vital in creating strong, healthy, empowered communities, individuals, and communities. I think your questions earlier in regard to measures and metrics, we not only track what we are funded through, both for Medicare or private insurance, but we track all the holistic approach and services that we have, whether it's advising families or youth or students. So when we see a family that's getting chemical services, we also meet with the youth and the whole family. And we talk there not only about their chemical use and abuse, but also gang activity, education issues. In fact, we are featured by Hazelden here in this guide, the Latino Guide to Emotional Well-Being. They studied all of our programs and looked at how effective they are, and this is now a national model. It's distributed by Hazelden nationwide. That concludes my remarks.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your presentation. Anything further, Senator?
I do have two quick, if you indulge me for one more minute, or we have two people who are testifiers who would like to take maybe 60 seconds of your time.
Are you sure they're going to keep it to that?
I'm assured that it would take 60 seconds.
All right. Please approach and give your names. 60 seconds is not a long time, so we find these grow. All right, great. Thank you. Say your name and please begin your remarks. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Pamela Wright, and I am a woman who has suffered from chemical addiction as well as mental health for over 20 years. I am also a client at Resource Center. I've been sober now almost 8 months. I'm getting the necessary help that I need to stay clean as well as handle my mental health issues. So the increase in funding would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.
And thank you. Congratulations, by the way. That's pretty fabulous.
Good afternoon. I'm Adrian Thompson. I'm also representing alumni resource and representing resource. But in the opening, we heard testimony on how quick access to treatment is cost effective. It saves the state money. But there's another aspect. It saves lives. And in all too many cases, having quick access to treatment boils down to life and death. I can go on with examples. We'll be here all day, but I probably have 15 seconds left. Another point I want to get across is public safety. You know, when I have access to treatment and people like me have access to treatment, the community is safer. So, chemical dependency and treatment affects us all. So I'll close with that.
Thank you, and thank you for being willing to tell your story, to put, dot the I on what we're talking about here, cross the T. Senator Franzen, are there any questions here? I did want to ask you, I noticed in the bill there's a segment that talks about not only the rate increase, but DHS to develop performance measures to assess the outcomes of chemical dependency treatment. I don't know if we need to put those in this bill or not, but I think there's some great suggestions in the materials that were presented by CLU. We ought to be measuring whether or not there is quicker access to treatment, whether or not there are qualified, licensed, bilingual, and culturally competent providers as a result of this. Are there reduced gaps in the areas of access, quality of services, and an increased capacity to make sure the services are appropriate to the person that's seeking them. So I don't know that is to be articulated here, given your request that DHS develop this, but if you wanted to add some language that said, in the development of those performance measures, in particular, I'm interested in measures that address these issues about qualified, licensed, bilingual, bicultural, and areas and services that are draw upon the strengths of a person's culture and faith and background, so that they're so that it draws on the person's culture.
Madam Chair, I would say that would be a friendly amendment, and I don't know if we should take that up now. It's going to finance, but this is the policy committee, so I would think this would be the appropriate committee to make that change in the language.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just to that point, I mean, in a broader sense, I'm glad that these guys have, that Senator Franzen, you've brought this forward. I think we need to continue to do some work when we get, if this moves to the Finance Committee, to talk about the Consolidated Treatment Fund. However, in the past couple of years, Madam Chair, we have done some significant work on this issue of culturally specific work, and there's even now a kind of a rate increase if you are culturally specific. The department has been doing a lot of work trying to figure out what that is, so that we understand what it means to be culturally specific in each culture, and if we're going to give one a rate increase on top of what they're asking, we really need to figure that out. So the department has been working with stakeholders over the last 2 years, I know, to really flesh that out so that it is part of our regulatory strategy. So that is, I just wouldn't want to take up a lot of time in Senator Franzen's bill if that's work that's working concurrently, as well as DHS has a diversity group committee that works on this pretty consistently. So hopefully when we come to the Finance Committee, Senator Franzen and the department can be prepared to talk about that so that we don't have to put redundancy in language in your bill.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Seeing some head shaking over there, I move the bill.
Senator Hoffman moves the bill. There is further discussion. I see Senator Marty's hand.
Madam Chair, in response to those comments of the Chair and Senator Hayden about culturally specific, that's the one of the points of this bill, but I also think that this study is supposed to look at all consolidated treatment fund services to make sure we have good performance measures. So I think the culturally specific is an important part of it, but I think this section 2 seems to go beyond that, which I think is appropriate. So maybe you can work that out before.
Yes, I appreciate that. And I think that Senator Eaton would like to say something before we vote on this motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to kind of second what Senator Marty was saying. We have grossly underfunded treatment in this state. It is pretty tragic what people get that they call treatment, and I think that it's time to raise the rates.
Thank you. And then I would just reiterate that I wanted to make sure that you had a chance to say it's been 20 years or so before since there's been a rate increase. I can't imagine how this system is surviving under that difficulty. And secondly, we can discuss further, but I see that you're going to take a look at measurement and outcomes. But I do think in this environment, when you dig down a little further in terms of the disparities, that we really need constantly to communicate our desire that in the course of taking a look at these measurements that we're paying very close attention to those disparities. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Oh, excuse me. I want to make sure we got the amendment, the motion right. The motion was that the bill pass as amended and be referred to finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members.
All right, Senator Hayden. Senator, Franzen. I'm jumping here. Senator Franzen has another bill, 948, Fetal Alcohol Syndrome Grant Appropriation.
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate file 948 expands fetal alcohol prevention services to several communities across Minnesota. It builds off a successful integrated care model from Olmsted and St. Louis counties. And we're pleased, actually, that the governor included recommended funding for fetal alcohol spectrum disorder prevention in his supplemental budget bill at $540,000 each year. Our bill asked for quite a bit more, specifically $2 million each year, so that each year we can expand these services into more communities statewide. And the problem, you have several handouts with you. The problem is each year we're estimating approximately 5,367 pregnant women in Minnesota that expose their babies to alcohol and thus put them at risk of fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. Children diagnosed with FASD incur Medicaid costs 9 times higher than a child without. That's $16,782 versus $1,859. So this bill will address that by saving taxpayer dollars that will otherwise go for expensive health and educational services to mitigate the effects of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. What this bill does is appropriate the $2 million each year to support effective local partnerships between local governments and community organizations with a direct focus on helping at-risk mothers to stay clean during their pregnancy. Organizations statewide, such as Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, will work with community partners to ensure the most effective best practices are deployed across the state to prevent a truly 100% preventable disease, a disability. With that, I'll jump right to our testifier today. We have several members of MOFAS with us to testify of the need. I also want to point out, too, one of your packets also has a letter from former First Lady of Minnesota, Susan Carlson, who's been working on this issue for many, many years, and she's actually one of the founding members of MOFAS, who was able to testify in the other body and wasn't able to be here today, but I'd like to highlight her letter talking about how the research has shown that alcohol causes far greater harm to the brain than any other drug combined. So when we talk about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, it's a more compelling issue if you think about it, the effects it has on the brain relative to other drugs, and we certainly don't talk about it enough, inclusive I met a gentleman, a young man, who suffers from this disability, and he's in school right now, and he's been labeled as a problem child, when in fact he part of his condition, he has regular outbursts that he can't control. So it's certainly a disability that's not as well known or addressed in the school setting, and MOFES has done a great job to partner with Minneapolis Public Schools and others to really bring this issue and have screening earlier on so we can be able to detect and be able to provide the supports our kids need through school and life. So with that, I will pass it on to MOFES, Board Chair.
Thank you. Would you introduce yourself and begin your testimony?
Yes, thank you. I'm Laura Block. I'm a volunteer and a board member at the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. I am also a mom. My 18-year-old son lives every day with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill, which will fund programs and provide long-term intensive support services to pregnant women who are at risk of having a child with FASD. It's estimated that each year in Minnesota, 5,300 babies are born who have already been prenatally exposed to alcohol. Prenatal exposure to alcohol causes permanent brain damage, physical defects, including facial, heart, and lung defects, and it is the number one cause of developmental disability. This is a disability that you cannot outgrow. The results are lifelong. And, of course, the tragic irony of this issue is that FASD is preventable if a woman will just abstain from alcohol use during her pregnancy. The impact of prenatal exposure is also an underlying factor in school disruptions, in criminal behavior, in out-of-home placements, and in homelessness, and many other vulnerabilities. Prenatal alcohol exposure has a profound impact on our society and on our state. The human cost is obvious and devastating. The financial impact is huge. One parent that we work closely with has kept track of how much money her adopted daughter has cost the county and the state. And she reports the cost of services for her daughter, who is now 20 years old, has already reached $1.7 million. And remember, this is for a preventable disability. Unfortunately, this is not an isolated case. The CDC estimates that the lifetime cost to society for publicly supported programs for one person with FASD is $2.5 million. Preventing harm from prenatal exposure by high-risk chemically dependent mothers is extremely difficult, but very, very necessary. Many women who are given a clear and direct information about the risks of drinking while pregnant will make the choice to abstain in order to have a healthy baby. For some women who are struggling with addiction, it is not a simple choice just to not drink during those 9 months. Senate File 948 goes to the very heart of this problem. This program looks at the multiple complex needs of women who are struggling with addiction during pregnancy, and it provides a way for women to receive support services they need to abstain from substance during pregnancy, to maintain custody of their children, and to lead healthy and productive lives. A program like the CRAFT Project in Olmsted County provides a safe and effective way to support healthy pregnancy outcomes and decrease the cost to society. Failure to support these moms results in a very high cost to the state, including foster care and out-of-home placements, adoption subsidies, PCA services, waivers, medical costs, including mental health treatments, and special education services, just to name a few. This bill would provide funding to replicate successful programs statewide, such as the CRAFT program. This program proves that given the right support, having a healthy pregnancy can be a reality for every mother. It is working. The last report from Olmsted County from that project reported that all 44 of the mothers who are in the program had received negative toxicology screens. They are living alcohol and drug-free. I was hoping at this point to be able to introduce you to two of the brave moms from this program who really wanted to be here today. They've experienced help from this program and are excited at the possibility of expanding this statewide. Unfortunately, due to all the snow in Rochester last night, schools were canceled and their kids are home from school and they needed to stay home. But I can say that we know addiction crosses all social and economic boundaries. Through my experience and through my work with MOFAS, I have stood with so many brave women who are smart and strong, and they want this help. They reach out for it. They're eager for it because they know that it means a better life for their children. This model in particular creates a community and creates friendships and relationships that help them maintain their sobriety long past the time of treatment. I urge you today to support this common sense approach. The handouts have already been mentioned, but one of the women that was to be with us, her success story is on here, so you can actually read in her own words what this program has meant to her. Thank you for the opportunity to address this issue.
Thank you very much, Ms. Block. We have, do you have two other testifiers?
Just one more, Madam Chair.
Maybe one of these was from Rochester and was not able to make it today. Okay, great. Thank you very much. So is this Katie Seaver?
No, my name is Jennifer Steven. I'm the Director of Finance and Administration for the Minnesota Organization on Fetal Alcohol Syndrome. And I'm just here in case you have questions.
Have some questions. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Thank you for your testimony. I would certainly invite anybody who is opposed to the bill to come forward at this time. Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing portion. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we had 9 inches of snow in Rochester this morning, so I had a hard time getting here myself, and I know that Katie and Eileen would have liked to have been here. Let me just add to the great testimony that was already given. As a former special education teacher and Title I teacher, I have worked firsthand with students who have challenges because of fetal alcohol syndrome disorders. And it is very difficult and challenging. And to think, it is heartbreaking to think it's 100% preventable. There's so many things we can't control when it comes to disabilities, but this one's 100% controllable. And I will just say the Olmsted County program, as you mentioned, has had a 100% success rate. We, in 2014, of the 48 moms and the 77 children with those mothers, there was not a single mom who tested positive for drug and alcohol use. And so it is a highly successful program, the type of things that we should be doing at this state. So this is to just take a successful program statewide.
Senator Franson, I note on line 1.14 that you are including Olmsted County and St. Louis County, requiring those be recipients of this grant dollar. Is there? Can you explain why we would target this ahead of time to certain counties?
Madam Chair, members, it's because those are the ones that are most long established. They've been doing the work for many, many years. They have the resources to be able to expand what their model looks like in the rest of the state. So they're the models that have been funded. And by the last biennium as well, we targeted to Olmsted County and St. Louis and Olmsted County only. We're including St. Louis County because that's the next one that's basically ready to expand. So we're working with organizations that have the capacity and the resources to take this to scale.
Are there any other questions? I just have one final question then before we vote.
Madam Chair.
This would be for Laura Block. Mm-hmm. Laura, I just would tell you that MOFAS pursued and was successful in a piece of legislation that I authored some years back that I've worried about, and I would like some report back on from MOFAS about it. And that bill was to make permissive the reporting of mothers who come in for prenatal care to child protection because of use of alcohol or drugs during pregnancy. Mm-hmm. And there was quite a debate about it at the time because they thought the report would create a surround of services. But what the care providers were saying is that it's causing people, knowing they're going to be reported, to not fully disclose what they're doing with chemicals and drugs.
Yeah.
So my concern is what the outcome has been from that, and also I've heard back since we've been working on the child protection issues in the state that there's a miscommunication about this, that some places social services is saying that these health care providers may not report a mother who is using drugs and alcohol during pregnancy, and that is not what the legislation says. It's permissive, saying that they're not required, but they may choose to if they feel it's necessary for purposes of child protection. So anything you can do to get the correct information out statewide on that, I'd be appreciative.
Yes.
And because I do not want to take away the right of it, first of all, the legislation does not take away. Mm-hmm. It's permissive but doesn't require. Mm-hmm. And that has to be clarified, apparently. It's gotten confused in the general public.
Yeah.
And then I'd like to know again for you to come back and tell me whether or not you think that continues to be the right position for the state to take. And that's on a separate bill and separate issue, but I just wanted to take this opportunity to talk to you about that as a board member.
Do you want me to address that now, or would you like
No, in the future.
Okay.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, I just had a question for Senator Franzen as we get to finance. 8% of the appropriation for administrative and technical, going to need to break that out for me.
Sure.
And I have some concerns over must for Olmsted County, must for St. Louis. Why not May? Can we do this competitively? I know we're going to have another chance to look at this, but if you could come prepared, I would appreciate that. Thanks.
Thank you.
Any further discussion on the motion to pass 948? No amendment. And be referred to finance. All those in... Oh, Senator Nino.
Did we amend this bill? Or?
We did not amend this bill. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The bill passes.
Thank you very much.
And now we are going to go to Senate File 1049 at your request, Senator Hayden. So we're just reordering the agenda for those that are following. We'll move 655. I don't know if we'll be able to get to that at this time, but if not, it'll be the first bill at 5:30.
Madam Chair, I don't think we have that.
Senator Nelson?
I don't believe we have this in our packets.
I don't have it.
We do not have Senate File 1049 in our packet.
Nope. Mine stops at 6:55.
We have 6:55.
It's about to be distributed.
Thank you.
Just a little snafu. Our staff does a great job trying to get everything ready for these committee hearings, so.
Thank you. I would agree.
I'm just guessing they're not going anywhere.
Thank you.
We're anticipating taking this one up first, Senator Hayden, so we were holding the materials for the evening hearing back. That's why there's been a delay in the distribution.
I totally understand, Madam Chair. I can get started if you want me to, and have members read the bill.
Is there an amendment to this bill as well?
There is an amendment to this bill, Madam Chair. There is.
It's a delete all amendment.
It's just an author's amendment to kind of get the bill in the shape that I want out of some concerns from some of the stakeholders.
Okay. Senator Hayden offers the A2 author's amendment to Senate File 1049. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. And it should have been distributed, and so you can begin, Senator Hayden.
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have Senate File 1049, a bill to implement some of the recommendations of the Task Force on Foreign Trained Physicians. We've already moved the amendment. It removed the state. One of the things it did do was, from the original bill, was remove the statewide councils. We felt the council was redundant, and the work was already being done. It also addresses some concerns groups had, including the Board of Medical Practice and the Physician's Assistants. I know that if members have further questions, I believe that can be addressed by council or the Department of Health. Madam Chair and members, the 15-member task force was created in 2014 and included representatives from the health system, higher education, nonprofit, government, and foreign-trained physicians. Among their findings, they discovered that Minnesota's largest immigrant refugee communities are underrepresented amongst the state's physicians. Immigrant physicians face significant barriers, and many of these barriers could be addressed with strategic, coordinated public-private action. To speak further on the bill, I have Yette Anderson to kind of go over the bill, and then we do have one of our foreign-trained physicians, Mimi Ode, who would like to testify briefly as well.
Ms. Anderson, say your name into the microphone and begin your testimony, please.
My name is Yette Anderson. Madam Chair, members, I am pleased to present Senate File 1049. This bill is a culmination of 10 years of work by our immigrant physicians, community advocates, and it sets the stage for us to put more of the foreign-trained doctors to work helping meet our healthcare workforce needs and reducing healthcare disparities. Last year, Senator Hayden stated the legislature created a task force to work on the barriers these doctors face becoming part of our medical community. The task force brought together stakeholders from government, higher education, the immigrant community. It included the University of Minnesota, MinSCU, the Mayo Clinic, the International Institute, and even the Federal Reserve Bank. There's a handout for you about the task force, and the key principle of the task force was to maintain the quality of medical care while addressing the licensure issues. The task force heard compelling stories from immigrant physicians living in Minnesota, and the report lays out the barriers that several hundred physicians face in entering residency and practice, and it recommends the most comprehensive strategy thus far. The bill includes many of the report's recommendations and will help create steps for more immigrant physicians to move through the current education and licensing system. The resources in the bill will help immigrant physicians understand their options and next steps. It will provide help preparing for licensing tests and residency. It creates a process for immigrant physicians to document their skills to residency programs and improve their chances for admission. And it creates several dedicated residency slots for immigrant physicians. Without these new mechanisms, foreign-trained physicians will continue to be at a great disadvantage, and that robs the healthcare system of needed providers. The bill also directs the commissioner to continue to work with stakeholders to look at remaining issues, examine non-physician careers, and explore any licensing or regulatory options that would facilitate the process. And this work of the commissioner will be done with the stakeholders. Hennepin County Medical Center, North Memorial, the Mayo Clinic, and others have expressed interest in hiring these physicians once they become licensed. This bill will help more immigrant physicians serve their communities and all patients, and we respectfully ask for your support.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. You have another testifier, Senator Hayden. Would you introduce yourself and begin your testimony?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee members. My name is Mimi Wu, and I'm a physician from Burma. I immigrated to the United States following my parents to get away from a rather oppressive regime, and I came to the U.S. And in the meantime, I did manage to get another position with the UN to work as a UN physician in Uganda and also as a WHO consultant. So, and when the contract ended, I came back to the United States. When I came back to the U.S., I took the United States medical licensure exams, the same ones that all the American medical graduates have to take. And I did pass the exams, and I have what is called an ECFMD certificate stating that I passed all the United States medical licensure exams. I applied to residencies, several residencies, but I did not get a position. They all stay. I find out why I did not get a position. They say that in spite of having 13 years of clinical experience as well as an experience with the United Nations, I did not have clinical experience in the U.S. And also, the year that I graduated was a long time ago. In spite of passing the very same U.S. medical licensure exams, current ones. So I did not get into a residency. And we've heard a lot of people mentioning that we would be diluting the quality of the services here. I just wanted to remind everyone that we already have a doctorate from the countries that we come from, and also another doctorate here by passing the United States medical licensure exams. And also, to take the USMLEs, our schools have to be recognized by the World Health Organization. If our schools are not recognized by the World Health Organization, we are not even allowed to take the USMLEs. I just want to clarify that situation. And for the U.S. clinical experience, I just wanted to mention one thing. For refugees who come from places that has not even functioning toilets, they come here, and once they are here in America, sometime later they are using cell phones, and they can use computers. For us, we have already have our doctorates, and also, again, have doctorates again, so we are teachable. Just wanted to mention that.
Thank you.
And I couldn't get into a residency, so I work as an interpreter. I work as a phlebotomist in a hospital. I work as an interpreter, including the Center for Victims of Torture, and I've heard such of horror stories, and if I have not come out from Burma, I'd be dead by now, that's for sure. And yes, all of the clients ask me, as an interpreter, they all ask me, why are you not our physician? You passed the U.S. medical licensure exams. Well, the thing is, we are invited by the United States to come as immigrants and refugees. Thank you very much for inviting us. But we are faced by an oppressive system or lack of a unified system thereof. That's what we face.
Good, very good. That's good.
Thank you. I'm sorry. we are one of the diverse Burmese. We are one of the diverse population also, and we contribute to a lot of health disparities. Minnesota is home for health disparities. Thank you. Okay. I'm sorry.
So we're good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you.
That's fine. Thank you very much, and I do appreciate the point you're making about what we talked about earlier, especially, you know, the capacity to build a workforce that reflects a broader set of cultures and belief systems and faiths, and what a proposal like this can bring, along with all the other advantages that you bring to us in healthcare. So thank you for your testimony. I think we have one other person, Senator Hayden.
No, Madam Chair. It looks like I think we're okay. We're ready to stand for questions from the committee, unless there is someone in opposition to the bill.
Okay. Well, there was a Ruth Martinez that wanted to speak very briefly to this from the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice. Thank you. Hello, Ms. Martinez. Martinez.
Thank you very much. I'm Ruth Martinez, Executive Director of the Board of Medical Practice. I will be very brief. I have just seen the A2 amendment, had a chance to review it. I believe it addresses all of the concerns that the board has raised, and I want to thank the authors for those amendments. And with that, I think the board would remain neutral and have no opposition to this. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very, very much. Is there any opposition, any oppositional voices that wish to be heard at this time? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing and bring it in for questions from the members of the committee. I think there are none. Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, just a comment that I'm pleased that the task force has come together and been able to get the Board of Medical Practice be neutral. I think this is very important, not only for the shortage of cultural diversity in the medical practice, but also for the shortage of providers, period. And when we have well-trained, experienced people from other countries who meet the tests and everything else, I think this will help facilitate getting this moving forward. I think it's a win for the providers and a win for the patients they treat.
Good. Madam Chair, I'd...
Okay, Senator Hayden, you would like to move your
Thank
bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move Senate File 1049 to the Committee on Finance.
As amended.
Any
further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. And the motion passes. Thank you. And we
Thank
are
you.
Now in recess, and we will be meeting here again at 5:30. Senator Hayden.
Well, Madam Chair, I do have one more bill that I don't know. I think it could be a rather quick bill, and I have a couple of bills that I'm also have to do later this evening. So if I could get this done, I think it would help.
Can
the
I
schedule.
Unrecess?
Or do you want to go on
I'm
recess?
I'm going to unrecess.
Oh, okay. Unrecess.
And reconvene us. We do have. If it's not a controversial bill or requires very little testimony, we can move ahead at this time. That's
thank you, Madam Chair. I have Senate File 655. It would modify payments to the state's 17 federal qualified health centers and the 83 rural health clinics for patients that they serve who are enrolled in both Medicaid and Medicare. And with me, I have Jonathan Watson, who can explain the bill and what we're trying to do here.
Welcome, Mr. Watson. Please say your name and begin your testimony.
Great. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Jonathan Watson. I'm the Director of Public Policy with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. I represent the 17 FQHCs here in the state. I'm here to testify in support of Senate File 655, and I want to thank Senator Hayden for introducing the bill. According to our estimates, roughly 2,100 low-income seniors use an FQHC during the year for their care. These are very low-income seniors. They're dually eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. Yeah. There was a change about 2 years ago. The federal government, the Medicare Department agency, pays 80% of the fee, and the Medicaid Department prior to that paid the 20% copay on behalf of the patient. On January 1st of 2012, the state agency no longer provides that 20% on behalf of the patient. So as these are very low-income seniors, it is unlikely that they have that 20% copayment to provide to the FQHC. So that just adds to more uncompensated care at our health centers. And as you all know, I've shared with you in the past, only 15% of our patients are privately insured, so we really don't have an area to cost shift. Moreover, this does impact the state's 83 rural health clinics, which my association does not represent whatsoever, but nonetheless, they are committed to serving the uninsured as FQHCs are. Just from a clinical perspective, just the policy rationale for this bill is that many of these low-income seniors have chronic conditions such as pulmonary disease, heart disease, and diabetes, especially when compared to non-dual eligibles. So imposing a 20% copayment on these individuals doesn't really incent them to engage in primary care, and these are some of the last patients you want foregoing primary care. Senate File 655 would pay FQHCs and rural health clinics at their legally prescribed Medicaid rates, which are prescribed in federal law. And this is triggered by their use of an FQHC or rural health clinic. We've been working with the Department of Human Services to resolve some implementation issues surrounding this proposal. However, at this time, if you would appreciate the committee's support moving forward on Senate File 655. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. Senator Nelson.
I just have one quick question. How are low-income seniors defined? What's the definition for that?
Correct.
Senator Hayden or Mr. Watson, either?
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Nelson. These are individuals who are on the Medicare program via age and then on Medicaid due to their income. So whatever income standards are in effect for Medicaid, that would be make them dually eligible for both programs.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Hayden.
So, Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 655 to the Committee on Finance.
That's correct. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those say nay. Passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
We now are recessed. We will reconvene at 5:30 in this room. Senator Eden is providing something, some nourishment for the committee members.
It's expected at 5. Yes, he said.